Thanks, Shane. Thank you very much.
It's the Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Good afternoon on this Thursday afternoon. How are you? 51551 for your texts. You can send us emails to ray@rte.ie. We have a very, very, very busy show today. Former President of Ireland, Mary McAleese, will be talking to us about her memoir, Here's the Story. I'm really looking forward to that chat. It's a brilliant book. Another brilliant book is Éireann's Diary, which is by Lisa McGee. And it's a companion book to Derry Girls. And we'll be talking to her after 4 o'clock. Liz Bonin, we'll be talking to her as well. She's presenting Future Ireland on RTE all this week. We'll be talking to her about that and David Attenborough and girl bands and loads of other things. Loads to get through. And of course, we have the quiz as well, so we better get that out of the way. Yes, it's our quiz of today. Today being the 12th of November. So we've cobbled together 10 questions on events that have happened on this day over the years, the centuries, the decades, all that. We're looking for two people to come on and answer 5 questions each. And whoever answers most correctly gets the prize. And the prize this week is a fantastic weekend away, staying at one of the 4 exceptional Irish-owned Flynn hotels located across the country. You and a guest will check in for a 2-night stay with breakfast each morning and dinner on one evening, enjoying superb service, delicious food and all the excellent hotel and leisure facilities on offer. 4 hotels in the Flynn Group. If you're paying attention, you know them by now. The luxurious boutique-style Imperial Hotel in Cork City, the New Park Hotel Kilkenny, set on 40 acres of beautiful parkland, the Old Ground Hotel in the heart of Ennis in County Clare, and the Park Hotel in the scenic harbour town of Dungarvan, County Waterford. FlynnHotels.com for more information. So, if you want to be involved, you have to answer our qualifying question, which is this. What is the longest river on the island of Ireland? What is the longest river on the island of Ireland? 1850 715 900, and we could be talking to you after 4 o'clock and you can win the prize. Good luck with that. Okay, we start today with some good news. We always knew deep down that Ross O'Carroll Kelly was an Irish cultural institution. But today we have official confirmation. And we'll be talking about that very shortly when we get them up on the line. Meanwhile, away from Ross O'Carroll Kelly, Now TV have done research, and I'm glad they've done this because it's come up over and over again over the years as to what you call that piece of stick that you hit a schlitter with. Some people call it a hurl, other people call it a hurley, and some other people say, ah, come on, you must have more important things to be talking about. So, anyway, they did research. Over 25,000 people voted. Is it hurley? Is it hurl? Well, drum roll, hurley edges hurl out. So hurley got 52% of the vote and hurl got 48% of the popular vote. Outside of Munster, only Sligo, Donegal, Louth and Monaghan vote in favour of hurley. 22 of the countries, 32 counties are to be recognised as hurl counties. So it does depend on where you are in the country. Now, me being from Kildare, probably not entitled to have an opinion on hurls or hurleys or come ons. But anyway, we would have played hurling. Yes, we would have played hurling. And we would have mentioned a hurley stick. That's what we would have called it back in the day. I'm beginning to sound like Kevin McAleer now. A hurley stick, that's what we would have called it. Anyway, 52% say hurley and 48% say hurl. And they're telling me now I can go back to my introduction to Ross O'Carroll Kelly. Yeah, today, official confirmation that Ross O'Carroll Kelly is an Irish cultural institution. It's exciting news. The National Library of Ireland has acquired the collected Ross O'Carroll Kelly artworks. That's an archive of the illustrations, the drawings and the sketches that have accompanied the books and columns over the years, all 20 books. To explain this, I'm joined by Ross O'Carroll Kelly creator Paul Howard. Hello, Paul.
Hello, Ray. How are you?
And the artist and illustrator Alan Clark. How are you doing, Alan?
Hi, Ray. How's it going?
Congratulations to you both. It's a big day, isn't it, Paul? It's a big day.
It's a big day. It feels very big, actually.
Yeah.
It's kind of, all along, as long as I've been writing these books, I've always felt that Alan Clark, the illustrator, didn't get as much credit as he deserved. So it was always me up in the front taking the limelight.
Yes.
But the artwork in the books, it's a huge element of the books. And I've said for years, I think Alan is a genius, and I'm just so happy that his work is going to be collected and archived by the National Library of Ireland, and that people will have an opportunity to go in and actually see it, you know.
Yeah.
So that's quite exciting.
And when you saw the first illustration all of those years ago, did something click? Going, oh, yeah. Now
yeah,
I see him.
Definitely. I didn't really have a sense of what Ross looked like. I didn't really have a sense of the character until I saw Alan's illustrations.
Yeah.
And that's the truth. And I'd been writing Ross for probably 4 years at that stage. And the second I saw Alan's first rendering of Ross, I said, that's exactly him. That's who he looked like. Yeah. And so I suppose he kind of made me feel closer to the character, to the point where when we were casting for the Ross O'Carroll Kelly plays, I think unconsciously we were looking for somebody who looked like yes, Alan's illustration yes, yes. of Ross.
Yeah.
And we found Rory Nolan, who is just, you know, one of the finest actors I've ever seen. But coincidentally, he also happens to look a lot like yeah, Alan's yeah. drawing.
Congratulations again. You're in there at the National Library with W.B. Yeats, Patrick Kavanagh, Brendan Behan, Christy Brown, James Plunkett, Colm Tolbean, John Millington Synge, George Bernard Shaw, Sean O'Casey, Samuel Beckett. How does that make you feel, Alan?
Oh, amazing. I mean, it's pretty exalted company when
yes.
when you list them off like that. It's pretty amazing that Ross is in among them now.
Yeah. So how did it happen? Were you approached? Did you offer up your services? Or what way did it go?
I approached the library a couple of years ago about it. I mean, I've been drawing Ross for the got to 20 years now, and it was kind of piling up quite literally in my studio, all these drawings. And I kind of wanted them to be more accessible to people and to be archived properly. So I approached the library a couple of years back, and we've kind of been in talk about it since.
Yeah.
There was certainly no rush on the matter because Ross is an ongoing concern, you know.
Ross sees the world in a certain way, but your illustrations probably paint the world as it really is.
Yeah, so the books, the text is Ross looking at the world, and the illustrations are the world looking at Ross. So I have the very enjoyable task of kind of undermining Ross's narcissism, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And you were commissioned by the National Library of Ireland to do two unique illustrations
yeah.
for their collection.
Yeah. So two illustrations, two sort of featuring Ross in the library, which wouldn't be his natural habitat, I wouldn't think. But, so one of Ross in the reading room and one in the library and one of Ross in front of the library. So
okay.
Just to kind of mark the occasion, to mark the acquisition.
What is he reading?
He's reading one of his own books.
Oh, right. As you would expect.
Isn't he upside down?
Of course.
So there was a launch, a virtual launch today. How did that go, Paul?
Yeah, it was great. We talked to the Minister, Catherine Martin, and she was said some very gracious things, and said how excited she was that it was part of the National Archive. Now, we would have loved to have been in there. It would have been a really good
yes,
day. It would
yeah.
have been a great thing to do, but to actually launch it live. But it's nice that the library have said they're going to put them up on the website over the coming weeks. I think all of the pieces. And then at a later date when we have this miracle vaccine and the country gets back to normal again, they're going to do an exhibition. And that's really exciting as well, you know, the idea that it can draw people in. Possibly people like Ross who would never darken the door of a library
yeah.
in normal circumstances.
And Alan, in that exhibition, there will be a cover that people haven't seen before.
Yeah, well, there'll be, I mean, Ross, as I say, is an ongoing thing. So there's new work being generated all the time. I don't want anyone to get the impression that this is the end of Ross. it's very much alive. And there'll be, as Paul says, like there's 15, 20 years worth of work there and more to come all the time.
Including our favourite one, Alan, which is the cover that never happened.
Oh yes, yeah. There was a cover of Should Have Got Off at Sydney Parade that fell foul of the censors, let's say, and was changed at the very last minute. So it never found its way into the public. So that's
yeah, you have to tell us what it is. One of you, please.
It was based on Demi Moore's famous Vanity Fair photo shoot where she posed pregnant and naked, except it was Ross instead of anymore.
Ah, yeah. I see why good taste took over and that.
Yeah, yeah. What's interesting, Ray, is that it was sent back to us and we were told, you know, people would find this gross. Alan and I didn't believe them. And it turned out that everybody was right except me and Alan. But I hung a copy of it on the wall in my hallway, and it's been there for 15 years, and everybody comes into the house, looks at it and says, oh my God, that's absolutely disgusting.
Well, listen, congratulations to Paul Howard and Alan Clark. Ross O'Carroll Kelly has arrived. He's in the National Library of Ireland. Well done, lads. Congratulations. Have a good day. Mind yourselves. See you. Bye. Ace of Base on RT Radio 1, 5 on 5 5 on radio.rt.ie. One hurls a game of hurling with a hurley or a hurley stick, says C. Ryan, with an air of authority. And I always look at the pictures before I start reading the book. I haven't started or looked at the pics yet for Braywatch, says that person who's obviously a big fan of Ross O'Carroll Kelly and Paul Howard. That's Aoife there. And we're at level 5, Ray. How can the quiz of the day winners travel to the hotels? It prevents me from entering the quiz. I enjoy it, though. Confused texter. Well, it's for when we get out the other side. You know what I mean? It's something to look forward to. You will have that weekend away in one of the Flynn hotels or wherever else to look forward to. That's the idea. You can't go now, but you can go in the future because this will pass. Now, in the future, yeah, we're talking to Mary McAleese after a quick commercial break.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Email ray@rte.ie. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Now, tomorrow, the Dublin Book Festival is delighted to have the pleasure of hosting an inspirational evening with Mary McAleese. It's at 7 o'clock during the special In Conversation event. Mary McAleese will talk about her new memoir, Here's the Story, and offer invaluable and inspirational insights from her many years of public service. That's tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock. And this is Mary McAleese on the line. Good afternoon.
How are you, Ray? How are you doing?
Good. Congratulations on the book.
Oh, thank you. It was good to get it done, yeah. Finally.
I'm interested to know why you chose the picture on the back.
I didn't choose it.
Oh, you didn't choose it?
No. I mean, it's one of a series. It's actually a picture of me as a child in Butlins years ago. And I gave the Penguin, who are the publishers of the book, a whole bunch of photographs to choose from for the cover, and they chose that one. So, and in fact, it's going to be the cover. That particular picture is now going to be the cover of the paperback version, apparently. So there you are.
So why do you think they chose that?
They thought it was sweet. I think they thought it was sweet.
Yeah.
It's cute.
Yes.
I think. I don't know. Yeah. I have no idea what judgment. These are the people who know what appeals, you know, and what catches the eye, I suppose. But anyway, there you are. That's the one they've chosen. It's on the back of the book.
Yeah. There's a sort of an innocence about it. There's a neutrality about it.
I guess that's right. Yeah, yeah. There is. Yeah.
I have so many questions to ask you. I don't know where to start. I understand you a lot more and your personality because I've been in your company once, maybe twice. And you have this ease with people. And I was always wondering, where did she get that now? And it's because you were a bar woman, girl, maid.
I was raised in two places where the public matter. My mum's sisters, and indeed my mum and my brother, were all hairdressers. So when I was growing up, I was, you know, in the hairdressing salon, which is a great place for gossip and chat and talking to people. And, you know, I'd be the one who'd be washing the hairs or sweeping the floor. But the other place that I was in my father's pub, you know, where you were serving and chatting and cleaning. And so, yes, they're very convivial, sociable places where if you need to have a bit of an odd personality to survive them, I think. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. And that's shone through in all your public life, that personality. And it shines through in the book as well.
And I think you have to like people. You have to be really interested and curious about people to make the best of it. So it's not a chore. I always loved being in the salon. I just loved the salon. Mm. And I loved the bar. And there were two different environments because, you know, one was all women and the other was all men.
Yeah.
Completely different environments. But I loved them.
So your dad ran the Long Bar in
Belfast?
He
did, yeah.
Yes.
He did.
Okay.
Yeah.
In there, what was it, a nationalist bar or was it a...
Well, it was in a nationalist area. It was in the Falls Road.
Yeah.
Yes, it was. And it was called a long bar because it spanned two streets. The front door was in one street and the back door was on another street. And there were days, particularly on big race days, where if you opened the front door, people would have fallen out the back door because it was so packed.
Right,
it was so jammed. I remember one famous day that it must have been some big race meeting on, and this was a bookies next door, of course. And my father was to the pin of his collar to squeeze more people in. It wouldn't do now with COVID, but he, at one point, one of our, a very famous barman in our place was a guy called Pat McAllister, who, an old socialist who'd fought against Franco in Spain. And Pat stopped everything. He said, "Everybody just stop right now. I've had an idea," he said, "how we can create more space." And everybody stopped and he said, "We'll scrape the bloody wallpaper off the wall." So that's how bad it was.
And you were very friendly with Pat, and as people won't know this, but as a result of him and his, well, I suppose, your chats, you became an atheist at one stage.
For a short time, yeah. Well, yes. Actually, for quite a time, actually, at school. Yes, I did, and applied to join the Communist Party of Great Britain and Ireland, actually. Yeah, under his tutelage, he was bitterly anti-clerical.
Right.
And virulently anti-clerical and anti-church. And you can kind of understand, in a way, he was a very bright man and with a gorgeous, delightful, soft, gentle face. But he had his very strong political views. He had gone to Canada as a young fella and had joined the International Brigade, had gone to fight against Franco. And then when he came back to Ireland, because of his politics and because of the role the church played, you know, in appointments and in jobs, he found it very hard to get a job. And because of people's attitudes to people like him, you know, who had fought against Franco, he found it hard to get a job. So my father gave him a job.
Right.
And then he was a single man. He lived alone. Great raconteur. He introduced me to Spanish. Actually, never mind atheism, really, because that was a temporary phenomenon. My mother saw to that, and the headmistress saw to that. But he introduced me to Spanish.
Right.
And his Spanish was diabolical now. Probably mightn't be that much better, you know, spoken with a broad Belfast accent. Right. And but he had a great love of the poet Lorca, Federico García Lorca. And that's, I developed a great love of Lorca's poetry thanks to him.
I'm going to come back to Pat McAllister later on in our conversation because you described him as a very bright man and an atheist. So that's I'm going to come back to that later on. So the Long Bar ended up being bombed, and another bar that your dad was involved in was bombed as well by two different sets of paramilitaries.
Yes, they were very ecumenical in that regard. unfortunately, the Long Bar, it was particularly tragic because loyalist paramilitaries left a car bomb outside of it, which exploded and killed a young woman, a mother of two young children, whose brother was a good friend of mine. And my father ran to grab her. He saw her falling. And what happened was the keys of the car, it seems, when the car exploded, they broke her neck. So she didn't have any serious-looking injuries. And my father thought that she had just fainted. And he grabbed her and was trying to revive her when the ambulance and the police, and indeed RTE cameramen who were first on the job, arrived. And it was an RTE cameraman who told me that he was the person who had to tell my father that she was dead.
Right.
And like, my father went out to work that morning, you know, his usual bright, cheerful self. And he came home a different person. That's the effect of trauma, I suppose. The second bar was bombed by that was loyalists did the first bar. The second bar was by the IRA. I have no idea why they did that either. But there was thankfully there was no life lost and there were no injuries. Thank goodness.
Yeah, but your family, like there was an occasion where the UDA machine gunned your house. Luckily, there was nobody in it. Your brother John was nearly murdered by a group of loyalist thugs.
They attempted to kill him, yes.
Yes, you were in the thick of it up there.
And John, of course, is profoundly deaf.
Yes.
So, you know, he was, I suppose you'd use the expression, you know, he was an easy target.
Mm.
And the awful thing about that was before they tried to kill him, they mocked him, the fact that he was deaf. Now, we didn't see any of this, though it happened outside our door. We were at home. He was at the deaf club that night and the bus stop was right across the street from the road. We lived on a main road and the bus stop was across the road and he got off the bus. These boys were on the bus with him, behind him. They had been stalking him. And they attacked him, stabbed him. And an elderly gentleman saw that and he came to our door desperately you know, obviously desperately upset. And we were at home, and my mum and I and the other kids, and listening or watching TV when we heard screams. And because we'd never heard John scream before, you know, and because he's profoundly deaf from birth, he has a different timbre to his voice from, you know, from people who are used to speech. And it took us a second or two before we realised, with horror, that it was John. I thought at first it was a bunch of kids because it was a youth club not far away, and I thought there were a bunch of kids kind of acting the idiot, and then we realised, no, it was John. But I often thought, you know, quite apart from the fact that they set out to, you know, to do him serious violence, and because he was a Catholic and because he was deaf, that the fact that they mocked him because he was disabled, yes, you know, because he had that deaf disability, it just says so much about the kind of people, you know, who were involved in paramilitarism those times.
Yeah, you said of them, there's some great put-downs in the book. I didn't expect them.
No, you didn't.
Well, you said paramilitarism did not generally attract the best brains.
No, and I think that is true. Yeah. Had it, you know, I think that is true. Now, at the same time, I would also accept that in the maelstrom of, you know, the sectarian conflict, things happened that made young men in particular, yes, make decisions, instantaneous decisions that they may have regretted later, but that they couldn't escape from.
Yeah.
You know, there were paramilitary organizations just waiting for the angry young men to be, and then they recruited them. And once you were in, you were in.
And of course, there was a lot of reasons to be angry.
And there were a lot of reasons.
And
to
we
be
didn't
angry.
We didn't understand that down in the South. Well, most of us didn't.
No, that's correct.
And that
Who could? It was so dysfunctional, Ray. It was so utterly, abysmally dysfunctional. When you live in a reasonably civilized society, it's kind of hard to understand the level of dysfunction in an unreasonable society, even if it is next door.
Yeah, it was only up the road. That's the thing. And you
correct.
You were shocked when you came down here and you realised that we didn't understand what was going on, like 100
yeah,
miles up the
bit,
road.
Yeah. And not so much even shocked that people didn't understand it, but that there was a fair level of disinterest also.
Hmm. You're highly critical of some people within this organisation, which is there in the book.
Well, I worked in it, and
yes.
I have to say that I hope that I complimented those who I thought did a great job.
You did, yeah.
And but those that didn't do a good job through times that when a good job was needed, you know, I was pretty tough on because I think they deserved it, frankly. But and anyway, I'm not the first to say it. I mean, it's been well documented over many years now.
You're the eldest of nine.
Yes.
And I'm third in a family of nine.
I
can spot my elder brother's personality traits in you.
What are those?
Yes, exactly. We used to call him the foreman.
He was, okay, there you go.
He never did much, but he told us to do everything. No, that's not fair on you. It's fair on him, not
well,
fair on you.
I was not a delegate. I mean, I can delegate, but in those days, I was definitely mommy's little helper. You know,
yeah.
When my mother says that she reared nine children, I usually tap her on the shoulder and say, "Don't forget, I reared five of them for you."
Hmm.
Because you had to then those times, you know, everybody was meant to, you had to pitch in and help. And my mother and her siblings between, she's one of 11, and she and her siblings between them have 60 children, 6-0. So and we all kind of lived, you know, reasonably close to each other. Martin would tell you, when I first got married, I couldn't make tea for two people. I couldn't make dinner for two people. I could make it for 22, but no way could I make for two people, with the result that in our first year of marriage, he put on about 3 stone. And then he decided the only thing for it was to buy me a freezer. And that was the upbringing. That was the formation, that there was always a crowd and you were always providing for a crowd. And you had to you had to be handy. You had to be a worker.
Yeah. What's the name of that malt bread? It begins with a V. It's mentioned in the
Vita.
Book.
Oh, you had to mention it. That's the thing. It's just breaking my heart at the moment.
Is that similar to malt tanna we used to have?
No, that was dismissive.
That's a Mary McAleese put down there.
I don't mind malt tanna. Don't get me wrong, I love it toasted, but you'll never beat a Vita. A Vida Luff is peculiar to Northern Ireland, and it is truly it's a very special taste. And it's one of our great treats. You know, when we go up north, is to buy the Vida Luff and bring it home. And my family, when they come here, they'll always bring a Vida Luff. But and friends from the north, when we were in the Aras, they would be bringing Vida Luffs. But unfortunately, COVID has killed off the Vida supply chain.
Okay, and Vida is a brand name, is it, Mary?
It is. I guess it is. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Martin. So in the book, and it's an interesting sort of study of two lives. You know how Martin turned out. Him married to a president of Ireland, and a very successful man, and did huge work in diplomacy. And then Bobby Sands, and you know, two people with similar enough backgrounds. And how do they end up in such, you know, opposite lives?
Well, that's why I think, you know, there but for the grace of God go any of us, and why I would have, why whenever we started to outreach to the loyalist paramilitaries, even though they had, you know, they'd cost us our home and our sanity at times, I felt an understanding, and not quite an empathy, I suppose you wouldn't call it, but a sympathy for all these young people who had been brought up with a very strong formation and a very strong advocacy around them, a strong culture that was constantly pulling them into violence and telling them it was righteous and telling them they were heroic. And that was very hard to resist. Particularly when I knew some of them. I mean, some of my neighbours joined loyalists, my friends joined loyalist paramilitaries, and some of my friends joined the IRA. So I could see how it was that we lived inside a culture that it was hard to transcend that. Mm. And I always regard Martin and I as particularly lucky that we did. I think home has something to do with it, maybe, or luck.
Education.
Education to opportunity that we had. We had opportunities, you know, to go on to college and to become professional people. And our parents, in our house, we didn't hear the kind of language of sectarianism. We didn't hear the language of resentment, even though it was, a standard Irish nationalist household. On the other hand, my father employed Protestants, and he employed obviously atheists and anti-Catholics.
Pat McAllister, there he's mentioned again.
And, it wasn't a house that where we were formed in deep and toxic sectarianism. Mm. So I think that has something to do with it, maybe.
You mentioned just there briefly about Martin and when you invited the loyalists down to the Oris, and that was done under the radar completely, but it's detailed in the book here.
Yes,
these were loyalist paramilitaries. There were people from what I suppose not the wrong side of the tracks is the wrong word, but there were definitely people who would never have been invited to Oris Nuachtarán before.
They would have sneered at it.
Yeah.
So there had to be quite an amount of work in preparing the ground for making them feel that the invitation wasn't some kind of a Trojan horse, that we weren't trying to proselytize or evangelize or turn them into Irish nationalists or Catholics, that we were about the business of doing a simple thing, trying to build a culture of good neighborliness where none had existed or where it had been damaged to the point that it was fractured. So we were about the business of trying to build good neighbors so that we could, so that if a time came, you know, when we could talk about hard stuff before you'd ever get to the hard stuff, because talking about hard stuff in Northern Ireland, talking about politics or religion, can so often lead to a rawness of language and breakdown, or it could then, things have changed a bit. And so we wanted to be able to just meet, have a cup of tea, talk about kids, holidays, anything, and prepare the ground for the day coming when we would talk about tougher stuff, and we would do it respectfully and could do it. Why? Because we were friends and now trusted each other across all those generations when there was no trust.
Yes. And Martin went up and he pressed the flesh, and he met people in circumstances and areas that, you know, an Irish Catholic man probably hadn't been seen in a long time.
And yeah, well, Martin grew up in a loyalist area though, Ray. And unlike me, I grew up in a Protestant area in Belfast. I had only Protestant friends in the street that I grew up in. My friends were Protestants because that's all that were in the street. My school friends, obviously, who were Catholics, I went to a Catholic school, but my friends in the street were all Protestant. Mm. Martin also grew up in a Protestant area, but he grew up in a loyalist area, a very staunch loyalist area. area, and he didn't have Protestant friends. And whereas my mother could say to me, go round the corner and buy a pot of jam, and I would skip round the corner and get the pot of jam, never thinking of any problems, whereas he, if he was asked to do that, and he's often described being asked to do that, he would be terrified. Why? Because in that short journey of a couple of hundred yards around the corner, he could be beaten, you know, witless.
Yeah.
That was the kind. He lived in a much more embittered and sectarian place than I happened to. Now, the place that I inhabited eventually, you know, did descend into naked sectarianism, yes. But growing up there, there was a chance for it, but the chance was blown, essentially, unfortunately.
When you got elected President of Ireland, Uachtaráin na hÉireann, was your goal to stay on for two terms of office, firstly, and secondly, to initiate the first visit by a queen or a king of England to Ireland?
Well, the idea for the Queen's visit was in my head from day one.
Was it?
Oh, it was, because I had talked to Her Majesty the Queen about that very thing before I ever became president, before I ever thought of becoming president back in 1995. I had met her and had lunch with her and had talked to her about this very thing. Not specifically, it had come up in a conversation when she told me that one of the greatest regrets of her life was that she had been unable to visit the Republic of Ireland, had never stood in it. She mentioned that she had 25 horses, I think, that had been trained in Ireland, and she'd never seen any of them run here. But then she said more seriously that it was that she'd never had the opportunity to visit. And so I was that was 2 years before I even before I became president, and I had no notion at that time that I could become president. So I had said to her at that time that, you know, that as the peace process was evolving, and I was very much involved in background work in the peace process, and also, of course, I was involved on behalf of the two churches, the two sets of churches, the Protestant and Catholic churches, in pushing a document that I and another and a group of us had at the instance of the churches. We had come up with a document on sectarianism, a plan for how the churches could help redeem the sectarian toxic atmosphere. So I'd been involved in all that, and I said to her, you know, that I hope that the work that we were doing and that everybody was doing, governments were doing, both the American government, Irish government, British government, the European Union, that all, and then of course all the participants in the North and the South, that would eventually conduce to a time when she could become a welcome visitor. So it was in my mind. Did I think I'd stay two terms? It, you know, going in on term one, it never occurred to me. No, is the answer to that. But as time went on, I felt that we still had a lot of work to do at the end of the first term.
Yeah.
Yes.
And in the book, I get the feeling that you saw the presidency as a way of achieving things that you wanted to achieve across the island of Ireland.
Absolutely.
And the Queen's visit was one of them. And you knew that the Garden of Remembrance was an important thing, that Croke Park was an important thing.
Yes.
And that her speaking Irish would be the cherry on the cake, so to speak.
Which, I did.
Yeah. So, like, there's a lot of detail in the book about it, and it's really entertaining, and it's insightful and all that sort of thing. But just to get to the... So how did it happen in the end that she said... And you didn't know she was going to say it, did you? And that's why you reacted,
no.
Like, with that wow.
No, because they played me. I mean, I had been told... I had suggested that she would use a couple of Irish words.
Five Irish words. What was it? Uachtaráin agus Acorda, is it?
Uachtaráin agus Acorda. And I suggested that those words, that small and simple though they were, that they'd be the first words we would hear her say. And
right.
They were the first words we heard her say. And I felt that they would have huge healing capacity. And I tried to explain that when we had meetings, you know, prior to preparatory and planning meetings. But I was told emphatically that this was unlikely because it would be the first words, and because Irish and the relationship with Britain was so, you know, had been so bad in the
past,
in the Irish language, that if she got anything wrong, you know, if it all went wrong, then it would be terrible. And I understood that, and I said, I'm not going to push it. But then she sent me an emissary, Sir Edward Young, her personal private secretary, and I explained to him that I thought these five words were important. On the same occasion, I also explained that I thought that she should that I asked would she consider going to Croke Park, and I explained why. And he came back to me and he said, yeah, Croke Park would be, he should love to go to Croke Park. She understood the significance of it, obviously, and she's very well read on Ireland. And but he said, look, the Irish language thing is just, we're just terrified that if, you know, that
she
it
got
would
it wrong.
Seem like,
yes.
if she got it wrong, it would seem like an insult. And I immediately said to him, forget it.
Right.
I'm not going to push it. It was only an idea. I don't want her to take any point. I'm not taking any point here. I'm accepting absolutely the bona fides. We'll leave it at that. But then... as happens, you know, every day of the week in any house in Ireland, the High Commissioner of Islamabad, the British High Commissioner, landed to our house on his way from, as you do, from Islamabad to London.
Right.
And he said to me, Edward Young's a friend of mine. He said that you had five words in the Irish language. And I said to him, don't you be raising that now. He's an old friend of mine. I said, don't you be raising that now because this subject's closed. Ah, he said, Edward just wants the five words written out, he said, so that he'll have it for the record. So he took a scrappy envelope, I kid you not, from his pocket, which he still has, incidentally, now in Perth. And he gave it to me, and I wrote the five words out. I wrote the runnings of Carja.
Phonetically, I hope.
I wrote them out phonetically.
Yes.
And he stuck it in his pocket, and that was the last I heard of that.
Until the night.
I was sitting there on the night, and when she got up, and I still can't believe how they played me, because my own staff was in on it, you know, and they were all sitting waiting for the moment whenever she spoke Irish, and I would have a heart attack. Yeah. Because, in fact, earlier that day, I had given her as a gift a little replica of a book that was prepared for Queen Elizabeth I when she met Gronewill.
Right.
It was a little primer in Irish. And that was the gift that we had given her. So when she sat down, I said to her, you were a quick learner.
Very good.
And she was really delighted that she'd been able to, you know, play a bit of divilment, but also... two good parts. She's put a lot of effort into getting the pronunciation absolutely right. She put a lot of effort into making the decision to use the language, as she did the same with Croke Park, you know, with going to Croke Park. She knew exactly how those things would matter, how deep they would go.
Religion obviously is throughout the book. How do you describe it? You're a religious person. I have to ask you a few questions because every time I read about you, I'm confused. You're confusing when it comes to religion, because at every turn in the book, religion slaps you in the face. There's so many things that have happened. Like two of your brothers, one of them was physically and psychologically abused by a cleric. Another one, John, was sexually abused by a cleric. There are so many things in the book that paint the Catholic Church in such a very, very poor light. And yet you continue to be loyal to that church. I don't understand, Mary.
Neither do I.
Try and explain to me?
Yeah, I will, because, first of all, there is this thing called faith that I have. I have a faith.
Mm.
And I've often said to my children that faith will be very lucky if it survives religion, because religions have managed to put us all in bunkers that, you know, that have made a nonsense of faith in God at times. But I stay with the church because it is 1.2 billion people worldwide. Its management system is atrocious, absolutely atrocious. This week of all weeks, we've just had the McCarrick report.
Yes. Yeah.
And we've also had from England, we've had the Independent Inquiry into Clerical Catholic Abuse, Clerical Child Abuse in England and Wales. And both of them tell a story of a management structure that is beyond acceptable. It veers from outright stupidity and carelessness all the way through to corruption. And so that's at the management level. The structure is appalling. It's old. It's based on old vanities of empire and clericalism and maleness and sexism. And so that structure is no longer fit for purpose. But the church, as the people of God, 1.2 billion people, Ray, it's the biggest NGO in the world, the biggest NGO, bar none, in the world. It runs 200,000 schools. It looks after the sick in the developing world. It looks after the poor. And I understand that down that conduit that good comes, there's also bad that comes with that. I mean, there's the nonsense of some of the doctrine of the church that is sexist, that is homophobic. And I want to stay in the church and with the church for as long as I have a voice to see if that little voice, along with other voices, can help change the narrative, change the management structure, which I say is just atrocious, And also ask very, very, I think, really very profound questions that are not being asked at the moment. The most important for me at the moment is that the church teaches that the day I'm baptized as a baby, and most of us are baptized as babies, that I actually on that day became a lifelong member of a church, and that I took on obligations, and one of those obligations is to be obedient to the magisterium.
But now, Mary, you'd no choice. You'd no choice, the same as I'd no choice. I had no choice to be baptised into the Catholic Church.
And you're absolutely right. Yeah, That's the point I'm making, that you cannot, with our understanding today...
No, but surely I must have choice then to leave it and to...
That's a different... We actually... Yeah. The Church doesn't give you a chance to leave. There is no such thing as leaving the Catholic Church,
But isn't that bonkers? Isn't that bonkers in itself?
Exactly what I'm saying. That's what I've written on. That's what my last book, not this one, but my last book was exactly about. We live in a world now where human rights teach us. We have our freedom of conscience, freedom of expression, freedom of opinion, freedom to change religion. The church has not engaged with that yet, but it needs to. I mean, the first book written on this subject was mine when it was published last year. Okay. They do not engage with our human rights.
Here's a bigger philosophical question. You know, whenever I talk about religion, people say, well, what would happen if there's no religion? Sure, we descend into barbarism or whatever. But I believe that we are born with an innate decency and a moral code as humans. We're born with that, and then when people surrender their moral compass and create some sort of allegiance to a deity, that's when the problems start. And the first 15 minutes of our conversation outlined that sectarianism.
I wouldn't disagree with you. Would not disagree with you. I think religion has a lot to answer for in terms of how it has cultivated contempt for the other in the world rather than a sense of a unified family under God. And it has to answer for that. But the truth of the matter is, 5 out of 7 people in the world today identify with one of the major world religions. It is still religion is still a phenomenally strong impulse, strong influence.
We're going back to Pat McAllister now. Very bright man. You're a very bright woman. Do you think that the Catholic Church, as it is structured, is beyond salvation? Like, you have tried, you've been knocking at the door, shouting. The empire of misogyny. What do you think?
Well, here's the thing. I believe in the power of change and the power of people to change. If I didn't believe in that, I wouldn't have gone into the Arras to try and do the work that we did to build the bridges. And I've lived long enough to see that there is the possibility for change. There's always resistance to change. I mean, we've seen that, the pushback. But I think you're right, that there is an innate decency. There's a goodness in people. I think the great thing about the human person is the capacity to love and to give love and to be loved and to accept love. And that is transformative. That transforms a lot of things. And for as long as religion tries to, if you like, knock that out of us or turn love into something that actually becomes a way of being contemptuous of other people's religion, then it has to answer for that. I like to think, I mean, I lived in a community a few years ago in Rome with people who were Muslim, people who were Eastern Orthodox, people who were Jewish. And among the things that just used to bemuse me, because one of my great, great close friends is a Muslim woman. She and I, when we talk about prayer, when we talk about God, we light a candle. Our faith could just be, if we were to distill it into 2 or 3 lines, it's exactly the same. Very little difference.
Yeah, but look at how religion has wrecked the world, and the pastoral aspect of religion which is obviously real and has been real for years and years and years, this is impossible to prove, but that would have existed anyway because we are decent, innately decent. We are nice to each other because we're social animals. No other animals descend into barbarianism. Because they're social units and we are social animals. Anyway,
I wouldn't disagree with you. And I do think that religion has a lot to answer for in that regard. And religion and people who are religious have to ask themselves that question. Is their religion getting between them and loving the otherness of others? Or is it actually promoting contempt? If it's contempt, then there's something wrong.
So you're there for the long haul anyway.
For the time being.
I suppose facetiously people have said to you in the past, why don't you go off and form your own religion?
Mm.
And what, I'm sure that's been said to you, hasn't it?
I'm exercising my human right to do what I want to do.
Okay, that's, yeah. Well, listen, the book comes highly recommended from here. I think it should be on the curriculum for secondary school because I think studying history, you know, in the general probably is uninteresting for a lot of people, but studying it through the eyes of you who've gone through so much and been at the centre of the whole thing for so many years is probably a better way of doing it. And I've really enjoyed our chat.
I think you're right. I always love talking to you, Ray. Thanks a million.
Thanks so much for taking time out.
Not at all. Absolute pleasure.
Mind yourself.
See you in Carrick and Shannon
again. We never got to talk about that, our little meeting in the cafe. Good luck, Mary. Yeah. See you. Say hello to Martin for us.
Bye.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Text 51551. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Future Island continues tonight on RTE 1 at 7 o'clock as part of Science Week. And Liz Bonin, who presents the programme, is on the line now. How are you doing, Liz?
I'm doing well, Ray. How are you?
Great.
Long time, yes.
I was talking to Luke the other day and we were chatting about you and your girl band and neither of us could remember the name of the girl band you were in.
Oh, gosh, it was called Chill.
Chill, oh no, yes, Chill.
Very cool name.
And you decided to not go for a PhD and join a girl band instead.
Luke is ribbing me about that all week. But I did then eventually, with my tail between my legs, go back and ask Luke for a reference for a master's. So all was forgiven.
Yeah. And science is where you found your career, really, and...
It was my first love. It always was. I mean, I had an amazing couple of years, you know, singing and then, you know, fell into entertainment TV, worked with you on the Den. And, you know, I had the time of my life, but my first love has always been science. So to combine that with a love of, you know, storytelling and making programs that I kind of discovered has just been awesome. It's been an interesting turn of events.
It's been a great two nights. I was going to say a great week, but it's sort of a science week. And you were on Tuesday night and Wednesday night and again tonight. You've managed to eat crickets with Brian O'Driscoll.
As you do, as you know.
I don't think he liked them, Liz, did he?
No, he didn't. But I have to say, when he tasted the meat alternative burger during the show, he was like, well, I'm not too sure. And then when we finished the item, we all finished the burgers and he went, actually, that tastes really good. So I think he was convinced by the burger more than the crickets. Yeah. I mean, can you blame him?
And it's all of that stuff. And we spoke to Niamh Damery yesterday as well. It's about future-proofing the planet, isn't it? Because we're running out of stuff.
Yeah, well, it's particularly this tonight's show really focuses on that. We're looking at all the scientific advances that, you know, are set to make our lives better. But sure, there's no point in any of it unless we really focus on taking care of our planet. And it's a relatively new sort of scientific discipline called planetary health, where we really realize that our health is inextricably linked to the health of the planet. It gives us clean air, clean water, you know, clean soils. It allows us to grow food. It's our life support system. So tonight's show really focuses on that. How are we going to give the planet the lifeline it really desperately needs in order for us to continue to thrive? And what is the science of happiness all about? We're investigating that as well. How to be happy.
How are you happy?
Do you know, I am really happy.
Do you spend a lot
I'm happier than I've ever been.
Are you?
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's about finding yourself and all that stuff. But it's also about taking I suppose the pandemic in one way has given us pause, as well as the horrific, you know, nature of it. We've all taken a step back and decided on, you know, the things that really matter to us, the things that we value. And a lot of it is the simple stuff, right? It's connecting to each other, connecting to nature, taking a breath, you know, maybe slowing down from the hectic pace of life. And for me, I kind of learned that about 6 or 7 years ago when I was working far too much. And I kind of rethought my life and I found my happy, Ray.
Great. You sound happy.
Yeah, I know.
What was it
well,
like?
I'm also really happy to be working with Luke O'Neill. I mean, it's mad.
He's brilliant, isn't he?
Supervisor at biochemistry when I was studying biochemistry. Yeah. So to work with him is awesome.
I describe him as the Dave Fanning of science. He speaks as fast as Dave Fanning, doesn't he?
He does. Yeah. He's so enthusiastic and so passionate about what he does. You know, it's fabulous.
Speaking of people like that, you got to interview David Attenborough for your podcast.
I did.
Was that daunting?
I've been lucky to... Well, I've worked with him on a couple of occasions before, so it wasn't as daunting as it might have been. But I tell you, the first few times I'd met him, I couldn't put a sentence together. I was stuttering. I just couldn't speak to him. He's an absolute
living legend. Isn't
he? Yeah, real hero of mine. So by the time we got to the podcast, I was actually supposed to be doing an event with him on Earth optimism, how we're going to take care of the planet. And it got cancelled because of the pandemic. And we were supposed to record that for the podcast. So I was very cheeky. I wrote to him and said, listen, would you mind doing the podcast anyway? And he very kindly agreed. He's just, yeah, he's an awesome human being. So I was really thrilled to get him on the podcast for our first episode.
Finally, I was just thinking about him and you and you know, you're sort of in the same area, science television, science communication. There are very few older women who have a high profile in that area. That's going to change, hopefully.
We have Michaela Strachan in the UK who's doing great things.
Right, I suppose we've Ian and Leona here when I think about it, but they're in the minority.
Great, yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, listen, I mean, in all areas of life, we know that gender equality needs a little bit of a, you know, it needs to continue to be shaken up.
Yes.
Yeah. So I suppose I'm happy to be trying to fly the flag in that respect. Yeah. But the same applies for natural history and science programming, I suppose.
But will we see more of you on Irish television now? Is this the start of something?
Do you know what it is? It's literally, if it's about this kind of subject, I'm your gal. So whenever I'm around and I can do it, I would love to do more. I've had a really lovely time being home as well. I love Ireland so much. So, yeah, it's been really nice to be home for a bit.
OK. And you told us what the theme tonight is. And Darrow Breen's in there.
He is.
And it's 7 o'clock, RT1, Future Island, Lisbon. And a pleasure talking to you. Mind yourself.
Oh, it's so nice to talk to you too. Take care, love. Bye.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Grumaga, Ciarán. Thank you very much. 515 on RayRTE.ie. Aaron says, I love Future Island and Lisbon. And she's a great presenter and is absolutely stunning, says Aaron. And I congratulate Mary McAleese on her fascinating memoir. I finished reading it last night and I wish there was more. I thoroughly enjoyed the book, says Damien. And I just finished reading Mary's book. It was such an eye-opener. She went through so much in life, particularly in the north of Ireland during the early years. It's amazing how she succeeded in so many things. I don't know how she fitted it all in. She definitely deserved to become the president of Ireland. I'm so proud of her. What a great woman. Regards, Anne. And during a sleepless night in August 2001, got out of bed and cobbled together a handwritten letter to Mary McAleese, then President of Ireland. I was asking for her help to support me putting a new school, Swords Educate Together National School, on the map. I'd just been appointed principal with a handful of children enrolled. Fast forward, January 31st, 2002, Mary turned up on a raining Cats and Dogs Day. Such excitement. We were sharing Swords Celtic soccer premises at the time. Not glamorous. Mary gave a goosebump speech on avoiding the teaching of hate. It was such an event. 10 years later, the school had grown to 460 pupils. Today, I say thanks to Mary McAleese. Never forgotten, says Gerard Kelly. Loads of positives there. And if you want more of Mary McAleese, dublinbookfestival.com. So she's in a virtual conversation tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock. dublinbookfestival.com. And the book is a great read and comes highly recommended. From here, where are we going? There. It's our quiz of today. 10 questions on the 12th of November from over the years. And a prize as well. A fantastic weekend break away, staying at one of the 4 exceptional Irish-owned Flynn hotels located across the country. There's the Imperial Hotel in Cork City, the New Park Hotel in Kilkenny, the Old Ground Hotel in Ennis, and the Park Hotel in Dungarvan. FlynnHotels.com for more information. Who will win? Adrian DC, good afternoon. How are you doing, Adrian?
Afternoon, Ray. How are you?
Not too bad. You're in West Cork.
Correct, yes. Down in Drimmel League.
DC is a West Cork name. There used to be a DC's bar there.
DC's in Ring, yes. DC's in Ring, yeah.
Oh, I had many a lovely meal there.
Yeah, lovely restaurant.
Yes.
Great food, yeah.
Yeah. If you had half an hour, I could tell you a story about Daniel O'Donnell taking my table there one night. That's it.
Yeah.
And everyone thinks butter wouldn't melt in his mouth, huh? Anyway, how far back does the DC name go in West Cork?
In our locality here, in our home place, it's going back to 1760.
Right, okay.
My mother's house, where she lives, just behind my own house, it's going back to 1760. There was a priest there, Father Timothy Deasy, and he was in court for, because his servant, stole a horse there in 1760 off a neighbour, and he had attended the magistrate in Cork with Judge Atwell Hayes, and there was no real punishment or fine or thing, but for the the time, which was the
big
Cork
news
Journal.
At the time, and you work in that beautiful hotel in Glengariff, Eccles Hotel.
Eccles, yeah, dating back to 1745, the building, yeah.
And the front of that is there's a conservation order on there, isn't there?
There's preservation.
Preservation, the sorry, yes.
There would have been put up in Queen Victoria's visit to Killarney. So the actual facade, which is kind of a wrought iron, and the name, name Eccles was changed there in 18, whenever.
Right.
1870-something or 1880. I'm not too sure of the date, but any time when the Queen's visit to Killarney, that was changed that time. You know.
Right. And did you get a lot of staycationers when the lockdown was lifted and before the lockdown came back?
Because like the Hajj in Mecca, you know, because it was a lot of people down in West Cork.
Yeah. Do you know the brilliant thing about it? You're breaking up a little bit there,
sorry,
Adrian, but the brilliant thing about it is you're going to get return business, aren't you, as a result of that?
Oh, because
I remember the first time I drove into Glengariff and I thought, where has this been all my life? It's such a stunning place, looking out over Garnish there. It's just a beautiful place. And you worked there every day.
Yeah, you did the Bay Run with us back in 2004, was it?
I did. And I stayed in Eccles the night before and it was lovely. I did it twice. The first one I think I did, and I can't remember what one I did after that. It's a lovely run with Bantry Bay to your right there. Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful run. Bit hilly, but a beautiful run.
Bit hilly, but very scenic, yeah.
Okay. You're up against Pat McManus and he's on the River Shannon. How are you doing, Pat?
I'm grand, Ray. How's yourself?
Where are you moored?
I'm in Athlone at the moment.
Right. There beside the Radisson, is it?
No, I'm up further. I actually met you in the Radisson a couple of years ago and I'm up in a place called the Jolly Mariner.
Right.
It's about a kilometre north of the Radisson.
And you're on the boat, are you?
I'm on the boat. I'm on the boat full time, right? Yeah.
Oh, you live on the boat?
I live on the boat, I do, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Did we talk? Oh, we talked before. And where did the rest of the family live?
Well, my wife lives in a place called Carnamagh, which is in Athlone.
Right.
She would spend a lot of the summer on the boat with me, but she wouldn't venture out in the winter now on the boat.
Right.
It gets too cold and wet for her.
So you'll sleep there tonight, will you?
Oh, I will. Oh, God, yes, I will. I'm grand and cosy here.
Right. Have you got a dog for companionship or anything, no?
I had one, Ray, up to a couple of months ago. Poor little Lenny passed away, unfortunately.
Ah, sorry to hear that.
Yeah, yeah.
And
had him for 12 years.
Is it too early to ask you, will you replace Lenny?
No, I won't replace Lenny, no. No, you become too close to them. You become part of the family, you know.
Yeah, yeah, that's very sad. Sorry to hear that.
I'm sorry to lose them.
Yeah. It works out for you and your wife and your four children that you're on the boat and theirs home and everything's fine.
Yeah, well, my children all have boats. Well, with the exception of one, we have three boats.
Right.
We have four boats in total in the family.
And, you're one of those four boat families. I've heard about you.
We're a four boat family.
Yeah, four boat family. That's brilliant. Okay. Yeah, you may not want to stay in a hotel, so you might give the prize to Adrian straight away because you prefer your boats. Anyway.
Go on.
Five questions each, all on the 12th of November. Whoever answers most correctly gets a prize. If we have a draw situation, we have a tie break. Okay, good luck to you both. And Adrian.
Yes.
The answer as quickly as possible, please, for both of you. Your first question is this. On this day, Adrian, in 1682, Swedish King Carl XI established an absolute monarchy. What are the main colours on the flag of Sweden? Red and white or blue and yellow?
Red.
Say again? No, he's breaking up. You're breaking up Adrian.
Now, red and white, sorry.
No, it's blue and yellow. It's blue and yellow. Okay, early days, don't fret. Pat, your question. On this day in 1918, Emperor Karl of Austria-Hungary abdicated and Austria became a republic. What are the main colours on the flag of Austria? Blue and white or red and white?
Red and white.
Is the correct answer this time, as it happens. Yeah, okay. Second question for you, Adrian. It's an audio one. Have a listen to this.
I will go up to the six-fingered man and say, hello. My name is Inigo Montoya. You killed my father. Prepare to die.
Okay, on this day in 1943, Wallace Shawn, American actor, was born in New York. He appeared as Vicini in that 1987 fantasy adventure film you heard a clip from. Can you name the film?
The Grinch.
Not the Grinch. The Princess Bride is the one we're looking for. Okay, stay with us. Pat, an audio one for you. Have a listen.
Well, they wouldn't dare. They love you too much. They fear you too much.
I don't wish you to discuss my children in this manner.
Well, you've got to hear from someone. You're never home long enough to know them.
I don't want to hear any more from you about my children.
I know you don't, but you've got to.
Oh, on this day, 1969, director Blake Edwards married that actress you heard in The Sound of Music. Can you name her?
Julie Andrews.
Is the correct answer. Do his sound easier, Adrian? Anyway. Okay. Question number three for you. On this day in 2011, Silvio Berlusconi resigned as Prime Minister of which European country due to the European sovereign debt crisis? Silvio Berlusconi.
Italy.
Italy is correct answer. You're on the scoreboard. Well done. Pat.
Thank you.
On this day in 2018, which former US First Lady published her memoir, Becoming?
2018.
Yeah.
No, I haven't got a clue. No.
Michelle Obama is the answer there, yeah. It was a bestseller. There you go. Adrian, audio question for you. Have a listen. You raise me up so I can stand the mountain. You raise me up to walk on stormy seas. Okay, that was the number one on this day in 2005. Can you name the Irish band? Irish band.
Westlife.
Oh, he's shaking his head there. I have to take your first answer.
Yeah.
You know now. Yeah, it was. It was Westlife. You said Boyzone. Okay. Sorry about that. Now, Pat, if you get this right, Adrian can't catch you. That's the way it is. Yeah. So it's an audio one as well. Have a listen. So, honey, now. Okay, that song was number one on this day in 2014. Can you name the singer?
No.
No
idea, right?
Okay. A sliver of light for you, Adrian. A sliver of light at the end of the tunnel. So if you get this right, you're on two. Pat's on two. And if Pat gets his final one. Oh, that was Ed Sheeran. Sorry, Ed Sheeran. Thanks. Yeah, so if you get your last one wrong, Pat, then we're into a tiebreak situation. Okay, good. Look at this, Adrian. On this day in 1965, Venera 2. VENERA2 was launched by Soviet Union towards Venus. The question is, which of these planets is smaller in diameter than Venus? Mercury, Neptune or Earth?
Smaller in diameter than
Venus.
Venus.
Yeah.
Mercury.
Is the correct answer? Under pressure, Pat, under pressure. Adrian's on two. Pat, you're on two. If you answer this one correct, you are the winner. If not, we're into a tiebreak situation. Here it is. Good luck with this. On this day in 1980, US space probe Voyager 1 approached Saturn. Which of these planets is bigger in diameter than Saturn? So which of these planets is bigger in diameter than Saturn? Uranus, Mars or Jupiter?
Jupiter.
Jupiter, you say? Is the correct answer. It is the correct answer.
Very good.
There you go. Okay. Adrian, sorry about that.
Not to worry. Congratulations, Saturday.
Hopefully, I'll get to visit you down in Eccles Hotel at some stage in the future.
Yeah.
Mind yourself. Okay. And we're sending out a Ray D'Arcy Show mug. It's on its way down
Lovely.
To West Cork.
Look forward to that.
Okay.
Thanks
see you, Adrian. Bye now. Bye.
Cheers, Ray. Bye.
Bye. Pat, you're off to one of the four Flynn hotels around the country.
That was a guess, Ray, that last.
Well, there you go. They count. Great talk to you, Pat. Well done. Mind yourself and the boat and all that. See you. Bye. Bye. Bye.
The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Email ray@rte.ie. The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
5 on 5, 5 on. Myself, my 21-year-old son finally sat down yesterday evening after your show and watched The Den. Brilliant. The birthday rap was great. How did he get through all those names? I don't know. We're back again Sunday at 6:30. And Ray, is it a spatula or a fish slice? Asks Dermot. Are they not two different things? I think they are two different things. Maybe they're one and the same. I don't know. Now, those of you looking for a fix of Derry Girls will not be disappointed by the new book, Erin's Diary, by Lisa McGee. It's a perfect companion to the wildly successful show and is filled to the brim with pictures and nostalgia that will keep any fan entertained. And Lisa McGee is on the line. How are you doing, Lisa?
Hi, Ray. I'm good. How are you?
Good. Congratulations on the publication of the book. Is this your first book?
It is, it's mad. I still don't quite believe it. I've only seen it in a shop before I believe it, do you know what I mean?
Yes, so you haven't actually seen it in a shop yet, have you not?
No. So I think I'll believe that I've written a book then. Yeah. Yeah, it was. I really enjoyed it. It felt like traveling back in time.
It's brilliant because it's Aaron's Diary. I just picked out this just to give people a flavour of it. So it's 1st November, 4:30 p.m. It's my cousin Caroline's wedding tomorrow. Technically, she's my second cousin, or is she my first cousin once removed? She's Mammy's cousin's daughter, so she's Granny's brother's son's child, which means, no, I can't work it out. It's melting my head. So that's the level of it, really, isn't it? It's the musings of a 15, 16-year-old girl?
Yeah, she's 16, I think, here. Yeah. Yes, yeah. And yeah, it's just a very, very silly. and she sort of writes lists of the things she wants to achieve and things she wants to buy. And it was just so much fun going back and thinking of all the stuff I wanted when I was 16.
And did you keep a diary yourself?
I didn't know. I really wish I had. It would be useful now for material for the show. But I always started every sort of 1st of January thinking I would and then lasted about 3 days because I'm so lazy. But I really regret it, actually.
I've noticed already that your Derry accent is stronger than the last time I spoke to you. Are you back in Derry?
I'm in Belfast.
Oh, you're in Belfast, okay.
Yeah, I've been in London a long time, and then the first lockdown happened, and London was a kind of strange place to be when you can't go anywhere. And all our meetings were kind of over Zoom, and we just decided we always wanted to go back. I always wanted to go back to Ireland at some point, and we just said, let's just do it as soon as we can now. So we got over here just before the second lockdown.
Right.
So it's lovely. We still can't see anyone, but it's lovely to have a bit more space. It's a bit greener, you know. It's nice to be back.
Yeah, yeah. The book is dedicated, which is an odd dedication, but you'll explain it to me. It's dedicated to John Hume, and I just better read the citation or whatever. For John Hume, thank you for giving Derry girls like me a better future.
Yeah, so I had wanted to dedicate the book to John Hume anyway, and he passed away, sadly, just before it went to print. And I was a bit worried then because I thought, is this an incredibly ridiculous book to dedicate to such a great man? But I asked about, and you know, people in Derry will give you a straight answer, and what was coming back to me was, you know, everyone thought this was a nice idea and that his family would like it. So I did it, and I just sort of think, you know, it is Derry as a comedy, but it sort of wouldn't have happened without the opportunities.
Yes.
The stuff he did gave me, you know, so everything's linked.
Yes.
So I just decided to do that.
I didn't get a chance to talk to Mary McAleese about John Hume, but she is effusive in his praise, as you would expect in her book. I think the line she says is, he wasn't our prophet, he was the prophet. And without him, there wouldn't be the peace that everyone's experienced in Northern Ireland now.
Not. Yeah, that was his legacy. Great man. Yeah.
Yeah. We should be expecting to see Derry Girls 3, but everything, of course, has been delayed because of the pandemic. So where is it at?
So it's written. We're all ready to go. It's quite ambitious, Series 3, and we had a pushback. It should be filmed now, but we had a pushback, and we're just sort of trying to line it all up again. So we're working that out, but we are all just dying to get back now. We all really miss it. We miss each other, you know. So as soon as we can, we will. We just didn't want to compromise the show because filming restrictions were quite strict.
Yes.
It would have been impossible had we shot it when we were supposed to. But hopefully not. We won't be waiting too long.
What word did you use to describe it at the beginning there of... complicated, involved?
It's quite ambitious.
Ambitious, sorry, ambitious.
Yeah,
yes.
It's quite, because it's, you know, it is a little show, you know, but we want to really push what we can do. So we've this Series 3, we've lots of big set pieces, and we really want to go for it. So yeah, hopefully we'll be able to do that as soon as it's you know possible.
Okay, like a lot of people, you were covering the coverage of the American presidential election on CNN, and
yes.
What happened between you and John King, the man with his magic wall? What happened?
So I was just sitting on Twitter watching like everyone and thinking at some point people are going to claim this guy as Irish because everyone was obsessed with him in the whole country.
Yeah.
And so I just sort of tweeted, "Is John King Irish yet?" And he retweeted me always. And I just like was so shocked. I was sitting beside my husband. I was like, "John King's just retweeted me." He was like, "No, no, it'll be like a fake account." But it was him. And it was, I think it might be the best day of the best night of my life. I was so excited.
I was saying to somebody, like, he just, his command of not just the figures, but the technology is amazing, isn't
it? Yeah. Brilliant.
Like, I'd love to see himself, Luke O'Neill, and Dave Fanning in a room having a chat. Like, it's just.
Oh, but I really hope it comes over and like.
I'm sure he will, you know, now. I'm sure he's been swamped with invitations to come over. Everybody wants a bit of him. So Aaron's Diary, the book. I love this on the cover. It says, "Writing is a calling, not a choice." That's typical Aaron, isn't she? She's notions above her station.
So many notions, and it's a bit like myself when I was younger too. I definitely.
Did you have notions above your station?
About being a writer, thought I was going to be a great Irish writer, and it's like but didn't want to do any of the work.
Right.
Just wanted to be that, you know. So it's sort of taken the, it's like making fun of myself.
Yes,
about as well, you know.
Achieved what is so difficult to achieve. No, I'm not sort of, you know, plum awesome you here, but to write comedy around such a sensitive issue. Writing comedy on its own is hugely difficult, and like, you know, the world is full of failed sitcoms, but to write comedy against the backdrop of the horrificness of the Troubles, like, that's genius.
I think it's about some, I think it's maybe about something being authentic, you know, and coming from a very, even though Derry Girls is insane, ridiculous, you know, nobody would do the things they do, but there is a, I loved Through the Troubles, you know, and so there's a sort of truth to it that you just, I think audiences feel that.
Yeah.
You know.
Derry going to get this, the dedication on the because I can't admit to understanding the North of Ireland sense of humour completely. And it even comes across in Mary McAleese's book a bit as well. So the dedication is for the people of Derry who laughed at my ambition and called me a mouth. Well, who's laughing now? It's like the two fingers there.
Well, this, what I'm really worried about, right, is like, that's Aaron has written that.
Oh, not you. Oh, so, I see.
Yeah,
oh,
no. Doesn't it sound, and it was only when my mum and dad got the book, they were like, "Lisa," and I was like, "Oh my God," you know, because the whole idea is that she's preparing this book.
Oh, yeah.
It's going to be published. And,
okay, so you'll take the dedication to John Hume, but you won't take the dedication. I'm joking.
No,
I'm joking.
That's my one. The that's first one's one, mine. Yes. The second one that's in Aaron's handwriting is Aaron's. So I think we need to clear this up.
Yes,
now,
you do. You definitely need to clarify it before the good people of Derry get their hands on Aaron's Diary, and it'd be a big seller up there.
I'm going to be in so much trouble if that. Yeah.
This is going, and it's a bit early to be saying this, but this is going to be an ideal stocking filler for anybody who, and there's so many fans of Derry Girls out there, because it's laugh out loud, and I love the lists, particularly the list of when she thinks she's coming into money, and all the things she's gonna. So what a Soda Stream, Tamagotchi. All those things. Yeah. It's a lovely book. It's a lovely book. So Aaron's Diary, in bookshops now, by Lisa McGee, and we're all looking forward to seeing Derry Girls 3 with its ambition. Lisa, thanks so much for talking to us. Mind yourself.
Thanks so much, Richie.
Okay, see you. Bye. Bye. That's Aaron's Diary there. That's it from us. Clarification here. A fish slice is a slotted, flat, non-pliable piece of equipment. A spatula is softer and is used for scraping bowls, etc. after baking. Hope this helps. It does. Thank you very much for that. That's it from us. Cormac O'Hara and Sarah McInerney are on the way. We're back tomorrow at 3 o'clock. Enjoy the rest of your Thursday evening.
It's the Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Wash your hands.